This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Good evening and welcome to Women's Health. Tonight we're reading from Women's Health, and the first section is called News You Can Use. 3 is the number of months of inactivity it takes to undo improvements to your VO max, a good indicator of fitness after 8 weeks of HIIT. The researchers who identified negative effects on the heart and lungs from a gap in training recommend daily exercise snacks, which are short bursts of activity such as sprinting for the bus to maintain gains. Going bananas. Eating more fruit from your mid-40s can lower depressive symptoms after 65, a recent study found. Looking at 14 fruits, including bananas and oranges, the authors suggested that their high levels of nutrients reduce inflammatory processes and oxidative stress, and in turn, the development of depression. Good evening. A study by New Zealand's University of Otago found that participants who mixed periods of sitting in the evening with moves such as chair squats and calf raises clocked half an hour of extra snooze time compared with those who were sedentary before bed. The key here, no intense cardio, just keep it light. And beat it. The menopause has been linked to an increased risk of heart disease thanks to lower cholesterol control triggered by reduced estrogen levels, but research published in Frontiers in Nutrition showed that sipping on beetroot juice can have a protective effect by boosting blood flow around the body. A more extensive recipe for cardiovascular health, there's evidence that the DASH, which is the Dietary Approaches to Stop Hypertension diet, is packed with fruits, veggies, whole grains, and low-fat dairy, and can also help circulation. Comfort zone, a simple solution for lower back pain. Go for a stroll. Research from Macquarie University found that participants who went for a daily walk up to 5 times a week for 6 months suffered less than those who didn't lace it up at all. So move it. Can you feed your brain microbiome? We all know we should mind the contents of our plate, but science is increasingly alert to the powers of well-nourished microbes on mood and memory. Science has been serving up evidence that your gut home to 100 trillion microorganisms, or microbes for short, isn't the only region of your body with its own microbiome. While the gut microbiome dominates the health discourse as effectively as Taylor Swift does the news, these squads of microorganisms dwell all over your body. From the vagina and lungs to your skin, the brain was previously thought to be sterile thanks to its protective membrane, the blood-brain barrier. Now there's debate about whether the presence of microbes is good or bad. Last year, researchers from the University of Edinburgh, who compared the brains of healthy people with the brains of those with Alzheimer's, discovered the presence of microbes in those who did and didn't have the neurodegenerative condition. Around 20% were the same variety as those usually found in the gut, leading the team to conclude that they had traveled from the stomach. The study hasn't been published in a peer-reviewed journal, where the seal of approval is given by other experts. So more research is needed before drawing firm conclusions. But it builds on a growing understanding of a symbiotic connection between brain and gut. While it's thought that our brains work downwards, hence gut feelings and butterflies in your stomach, there's evidence of upward impact too. That, in the same way your gut microbiome can send signals to the brain, what you eat can influence these things, such as your mood and memory. So what to eat? Think fiber. The key nutrient, which is derived from plant roughage, is lauded for helping control blood sugar levels and normalizing bowel movements. But when gut microbes feed on it in the lower intestine, it helps produce healthy molecules, some of which may end up in your brain. Eating enough fiber is a smart move in lots of ways, and certain types of fiber can ease food cravings, lower stress, and deliver a boost to your memory. But most of us eat just 60% of the recommended 30 grams we need daily. Whole grains, beans, legumes, nuts, and seeds are rich sources, while consuming all forms of fiber means they'll work in tandem. Overwhelmed? Focus on the big hitters, which I call the BGBGs. Beans, greens, berries, grains, and nuts, and seeds. It's a head start. Know-how. When it comes to friends, is quality better than quantity? A glittering social circle or 4-digit follower count might make you feel popular, but it turns out it's the quality of your pals that translates to feeling truly emotionally fulfilled, not the quantity. The research shows that having close, satisfying relationships is more strongly related to your emotional well-being than just having a lot of friends, says Jonelle Stroh, a professor of psychology at West Virginia University. In fact, a study done on 400 older adults, mean age 69, found that the threshold of connection for decreasing stress and depression was just two close friends. For anxiety, it was three, and for loneliness, four. So don't be disheartened if you find your WhatsApp chats dwindling, but ongoing investment from both sides must be made for a friendship to thrive. You have to be intentional about spending time together. Set small goals such as monthly coffee catch-up or a FaceTime call every week. Question: can I train just once weekly and still get strong? When it comes to fitness, some people take a more minimalist approach than others. But even if you can only manage a 20-minute workout once a week, it's always worth it. A study analyzed data from Dutch personal training company Fit20, where 14,690 clients, 60% female between the ages of 37 and 59, did a weekly resistance training workout for 7 years. They performed machine-based exercises, including chest and leg presses. Weights were adjusted over time to ensure that failure, which means the max you can manage, was reached around 4 to 6 reps. Research consistently showed rapid strength improvements in the first year, which then tapered off over time. Though it's worth noting that diminishing returns may apply to all long-term strength training programs, even if you're in the gym more frequently. The upshot? A one-a-day-a-week sesh is still a highly effective workout that's packed with benefits, including increasing your bone density and reducing mortality risk. So give it a go. Question: what are postbiotics? You've most likely heard of probiotics and prebiotics, but what are postbiotics? Consider them the love child of both pros and pres. Substances your body produces after it feeds on both, including B vitamins, enzymes, amino acids, and short-chain fatty acids such as butyrate. Postbiotics show promise for calming intestinal inflammation, easing constipation, boosting immune health, and managing allergies. What's top of the postbiotic menu? Think kimchi, kombucha, yogurt, kefir, and other pickled vegetables. But the best way to support a healthy microbiome generally? A balanced diet. Eat a wide variety of fermented, cultured, fiber-rich foods. If you insist on getting your prebiotic fix via supplements, your best bets are sodium butyrate, which calms IBS-related pain, bloating, and constipation. Question: do sulfites found in wine really cause hangovers? A glass of medium-bodied Cabernet Franc is a special pleasure. The dreaded red wine headache, less so. But is it the sulfites making you feel so awful? These preservatives in wine have long been blamed for hangovers, but a new study from the University of UC Davis in California suggests the real culprit may be quercetin, a naturally occurring polyphenol that can cause a buildup of the toxin acetaldehyde, which interferes with how the body metabolizes wine. Then this acetaldehyde accumulation, along with our good friends, dehydration and disrupted sleep, contribute to that throbbing headache and nausea. So that sulfite-free wine probably won't spare you the hangover. Sorry. Weighted for vest for full body fitness. Weights for ankles and wrists are a common kit in strength and Pilates classes, but could weighted vests make your walks work harder? One writer finds out one step at a time. In 2022, I was the strongest and fittest I've ever been. For 3 years, I spent every day carrying heavy equipment on a 15-minute hike to reach an outdoor workout spot for my personal training clients. When I landed my current job in 2023, the commute to my desk wasn't the same. Then I noticed thousands of women walking with weighted vests across my social fields. Carrying weight over distance lets you increase your heart rate without the impact from other forms of cardio, such as running, reducing the risk of injury. One study on women showed that wearing a weighted vest can increase your VO oxygen max, which is the maximum amount of oxygen your body can use during exercise, when slow treadmill walking. Other research has shown that exercising in a weighted vest can increase bone density by 1%. So to get those gains back, I upgraded my daily walks with a weighted vest. It's recommended to choose a vest at 10% to 15% of your body weight. I optimistically opted for the higher end, 10 kilograms. I set out to hit 30 minutes on the treadmill at my usual walking pace, and while I had to slow down, I finished feeling great. My heart rate was considerably higher than usually, and I was sweating. On days where I lacked energy, I removed a few of the weights, sometimes 2 kilograms to 5 kilograms. Other days, I'd walk 10 minutes with the full 10 kilograms on the treadmill, then take off the vest for the rest of the walk. A major plus was the idea that I had a workout while doing something I'd do anyway. Walking for at least an hour has long been part of my daily routine, and a weighted vest just adds enough intensity to my whole body. Any downsides? Just one. The pressure on my traps, the muscles at either side of my neck. A vest was most practical for fitting under a hoodie or a jacket, but on longer walks it gave me sore traps. A simple solution was to remove the weights from my vest and put them into my rucksack. Providing I fitted my straps tightly and comfortably, using a weighted rucksack became my personal preference. As someone with a tendency to sustain injuries from running, I can attest that wearing a weighted vest or rucksack is a good way to boost cardiovascular health without the impact, and it's something I intend to keep doing. My vest costs $48, and I've used it or its weights daily for the past 3 months. Know-how. Should I swap off vitamin C for an antioxidant serum? Vitamin C has been enjoying a moment in the sun, thanks to its ability to brighten skin, reduce pigmentation, and stimulate collagen production, which in turn helps to diminish the appearance of fine lines and wrinkles. And that's not all. It also neutralizes free radicals, unstable molecules generated by UV light and pollution that can damage DNA, proteins, and lipids, leading to premature aging by donating the electron that free radicals are missing, preventing them from causing harm. It's not for everyone, though. Its acidic nature and the form in which it's delivered can render it too potent for sensitive skin types. Enter antioxidant serums. Billed as a gentler alternative to vitamin C, they're making waves in the beauty industry for their ability to protect the skin from oxidative stress and free radical damage, often with far less irritation. While vitamin C serums primarily focus on brightening the skin and boosting collagen production, antioxidant serums offer a more comprehensive approach to repair and provide a multifaceted defense. Think of them as the ultimate girl band, rather than a lone pop star. As for the band members, ingredients include vitamin E, ferulic acid, niacinamide, green tea extract, resveratrol, and coenzyme Q10, which offers various benefits when combined. Team ferulic acid with vitamin E and the former enhances the stability and efficacy of the latter, while providing its own protection against UV-induced damage. Meanwhile, green tea extract is rich in polyphenols that have potent anti-inflammatory and antioxidant properties. In addition, they're soothing for acne-prone and sensitive skin. Together, the benefits of combining multiple antioxidants range from repairing and protecting the skin barrier to improving skin elasticity and minimizing pores. When choosing the right antioxidant serum as an alternative to vitamin C, it's crucial to consider your specific skin type and concerns. If you have sensitive skin, look for products with soothing and anti-inflammatory ingredients, such as niacinamide and green tea extract. For dry or mature skin, serums containing vitamin E and CoQ10 can offer both protective and reparative benefits. All in all, if your skin needs a hug instead of a jolt, antioxidant serums might just be your new best friend. Know-how. Ask the FitSkod. Want to run farther, lift heavier, or nail your first pull-up? Each month, we put your questions to our team of the finest fitness brains to give you tools you need to make good on your goals. And the question is, I started weight training last month. How soon can I realistically expect results? And Indy Mora, a fitness center trainer, says, as I tell my clients, you need to quantify the results you're hoping for. Do you want to build muscle and strength? Are you looking to lose weight? Or are you training with your mental health in mind? While weight training will help with all three, exactly how soon you'll notice results will vary from person to person based on your age, genetics, gender, lifestyle factors, and baseline fitness level. If strength is your goal, the fact that you've only recently started weight training means you may experience results sooner than more advanced exercisers. This is due to neurological adaptations. When you start at the bottom, there are more levels to conquer, which are often easier. More regular gym goers may have already hit those milestones, leaving them fewer, harder levels to defeat. These adaptations occur within the first 4 to 6 weeks after you start weightlifting, providing you train consistently. With a month under your belt, you may be feeling stronger already. Aiming for weight loss? By building strength, you'll replace fat with muscle in the same time frame, 1 month to 6 weeks. But weight loss is multifaceted. A calorie deficit tailored to your weight, height, gender, and activity level, a combination of strength and cardio training, and above all, consistency, all have a part to play. One study showed that it takes a minimum of 18 days to form a habit once a decision to change a behavior is made. If you feel you've done this in your first month, you've passed your first big benchmark. Going forward, you'll still see results, just slightly slower than you might do initially. A review in the journal Metabolism found that the best way to boost your basal metabolic rate, which means how many calories you burn at rest, is to have more muscle mass. The more regularly you train, the more muscles you'll have, and the more sustainable your results will become. What's more, as you progressively lift heavier weights, your brain learns to recruit more muscle fibers during each move. This allows you to produce more force and execute each exercise more efficiently, reaping more rewards. And the next section is called Delightfully, Defiantly Daisy. Embodying the role of a record-breaking swimmer was intense for the 32-year-old actor, physically and mentally, but it was a surprise autoimmune diagnosis following years of managing both endometriosis and PCOS symptoms that ultimately led her to finally slow down and listen to her body. Here, she shares what navigating chronic illness has taught her about what it means to be well. I look up and Daisy Ridley is standing and waving to me from across the room at the Soho House in West Hollywood. Dressed in a gray sweater and with her signature short hair, she somehow has that particular mix of star quality and approachability, as if your best friend from next door is now an A-lister. It's the same quality that gives her the chameleon-like tendencies that many actors strive for, with her acting projects ranging from portrayals of a troubled housewife to a socially awkward office worker and a strong and stubborn Jedi. It's all make-believe, the 32-year-old says, laughing. It's about turning up and being very present and being very open and available, but also submitting to someone else's vision. It's about being open to what other people believe, even if you come up with ideas of what that is. In her most recent role, Daisy plays the real-life American athlete Gertrude Trudy Ederle in Young Women in the Sea, based on the story of the first woman who swam the English Channel. Daisy executive produced the film. It's also the 98th anniversary of that historic swim, a feat Daisy learned about intimately. The first time I swam for the role, we were in a 20-meter pool, and I swam halfway, then started panicking. I was like, I can't do it. I actually can't do it. It was a classic light on the CV moment of, what the hell have I done? Guided by Olympic medalist Siobhan Marie O'Connor, Daisy trained for an hour and a half, 3 or 4 times a week over the course of 2.5 months before flying to the set in Bulgaria, where she swam for an hour and a half at least 5 days a week for 2 weeks straight before filming began. She swam in the cold and harsh current, moving her body in and out of the water, breathing on either side to make sure she was in the right place, sometimes hearing when cut was called, sometimes not, and always pushing and swimming and trying to align herself with the camera. On the last day, filming in the Black Sea, Daisy was told to just swim as long as she could. She has no idea whether she swam for minutes or for much longer. I remember thinking, I can't do this anymore, she says, emerging from the water with the thought, God, I hope that was okay, and turning to O'Connor, she saw the tears in her trainer's eyes. Daisy had not just done it, but she had done it well, both the cold and the current be damned. The buildup to it was worse than the thing. Once you're swimming, you're like, oh, I'm fine. And then after the fact, I was like, how did I actually do that? And yet Daisy is no stranger to doing hard things. Diagnosed with endometriosis in her teens and polycystic ovary syndrome in her 20s, she's been candid about her health on social media and in interviews. But she's dealing with another curveball, Graves' disease, an autoimmune disorder that involves overactivity of the thyroid. Back at our table, Daisy takes a drink of water, then looks at me. It's the first time I've shared that, she said, moving her hand along the glass. She was diagnosed in September 2023 after her GP encouraged her to see an endocrinologist following bouts of hot flashes and fatigue. The star had started feeling terrible following the filming of Magpie, a psychological thriller in which she plays Annette, a wife and mother who's dealing with a rocky relationship. "I thought, well, I've just played a really stressful role. Presumably, that's why I feel poorly," she says. Then, when she started to describe her symptoms to her doctor, symptoms including a racing heart, weight loss, fatigue, and hand tremors, the doctor mentioned that the feeling of Graves is often referred to as tired but wired. Only then did Daisy realize that she felt irritable. "It was funny. I was like, oh, I just thought I was annoyed at the world. But it turns out everything is functioning so quickly, you can't chill out." With the diagnosis, Daisy experienced some sadness, but also irritation as well. As someone who takes good care of herself physically, it felt to her like a random blow. On the silver lining side of things, the disease led Daisy to a more routine pattern of daily medication and a more mindful diet. She's been vegan for years, but decided to go gluten-free following her diagnosis. "I'm not super strict about it, but generally cutting down on gluten made me feel better," noting that it's said to help with inflammation for those predisposed to it. Daisy is still trying to find balance. Soon after she started implementing the lifestyle changes, she woke up and found herself listening to the birds and noticing the color of the sky and how it was so blue. "I didn't realize how bad I felt before. Then I looked back and thought, how did I do that?" The diagnosis has also led Daisy to a renewed sense of body awareness and reminded her that not everything can be anticipated. "I've always been health conscious, and now I'm trying to be more well-being conscious," she says. She's working to pay attention to her body to slow down and rest when she needs help. She's also integrating infrared saunas, cryotherapy, massages, and acupuncture into her routine, along with her beloved bath time. She's into crystals too, carrying rose quartz said to promote emotional balance. "I do a fair amount of holistic stuff, but I also understand that it is a privilege to be able to do those things." Daisy is, like many of us, learning to continuously listen to her body, a thing that she knows many women are not inclined to do. We all read the stats about women being underdiagnosed and sort of coming to terms with saying, "I really actually don't feel good," and not going, "I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm fine." At that point, we sit in a moment of quiet, and I let the sincerity and severity of that statement sink in. If you look at the list of health issues she's dealt with, Daisy has every right to be bitter or overwhelmed, but she's thinking about those who have it worse. In the grand scheme of things, it's much less severe than what a lot of people go through. Even if you can deal with it, you shouldn't have to. If there's a problem, you shouldn't have to just suffer through it. In terms of coming to terms with her new reality, Daisy's exercise regime has shifted as well. She's worked out consistently since she was 20, but she's been active all her life. Her mom put her and her two sisters in gymnastics as kids just to keep everyone busy and moving. Having attended a performing arts school, she also danced and sang. Today, her routine includes working out with personal trainer Matt Beaven, who also trains the likes of Lily James, Sienna Miller, and Jenna Coleman. "He's just so good. He understands bodies. He understands fatigue," says Daisy, who doesn't really do high-intensity cardio or running or things that just don't suit her body, health issues, and goals. Working in tandem with Beaven, Daisy integrates specialized training for roles that call for it, like swimming with O'Connor or doing kickboxing for another high-action role. For Jedi training, she relied on a lot of arm workouts. "Generally, my training stays pretty consistent, and then we tailor stuff to what I'm doing." And yes, her tolerance does end. After doing her press tour for Young Women in the Sea, she went straight into pickups. "I was just shattered, so I took a few days off of training, and I'm now on a deload week," she says, referring to taking a break or lowering the intensity of your workouts. It's been an adjustment for Daisy. Working out is a mental escape, too. "It's just an hour for me, and it's my time to do what I need to do to make myself feel good." The other thing Daisy likes to do for her mental health? Reading. A voracious reader, she credits her love for it as a major reason that she's an actor today. Two of her recent favorites include Meg Mason's Sorrow and Bliss and Roxy Dunn's As Young as This. Getting immersed in a script is one of her favorite parts of the job. "I get to the point where if I'm reading, I can't hear other people," she says. "Reading is my meditation." And the next story is called Eat Smart. Midlife eating disorders are hiding in plain sight. A sluggish metabolism, and weight gain are among the symptoms we've been told to expect from perimenopause, and you've been paying close attention. Women's Health chews over the science and asks, does disordered eating have a new face? Samantha's menstrual cycle was that rare and precious friend who prizes themselves on perfect punctuality. Every fourth Friday, without fail, her period arrived. Until last December, when it came on a Thursday. In January, it was a Tuesday, and erratic bleeding wasn't the only thing weighing her down. I noticed this pouch building around my stomach, the 39-year-old marketing manager said. She suspected a more relaxed approach to rich and indulgent food during the festive period was behind the weight gain. Then the hot flashes started, and Samantha's GP confirmed the arrival of perimenopause, the stage of estrogen decline that precedes your period stopping for good. The news came as a surprise, but more alarming was what happened next, for with this unexpected jolt to the body she'd long trusted for its dependability came a disarming urge. Despite being Teflon to diet culture and taking a diligent approach to fueling her workouts, she developed a sudden distaste for carbs. Before perimenopause, I ate the same as my kids, age 3 and 6, always serving the veggies and meat with pasta or rice, which I now feel I can't have, she says, referencing the gains on her waistline for disrupting her healthy approach to food. I'm so worried about gaining any more weight that I think I've suppressed my appetite. Poached eggs and smoked salmon used to be my favorite treat. Now the thought makes me queasy. It's a situation made more distressing by Samantha being the first in her friendship group to experience symptoms. Perimenopause has come quite early for me, and I feel lost because there's no one to talk to, alongside pressure to not let it affect me. Out of order. If the phrase disordered eating means calling to mind a teenage girl, recent data tells a different story. A 2023 study published in the journal Menopause found midlife women are at a high risk on a par with young people. 3.5% experienced an eating disorder in perimenopause, compared with a teenage prevalence rate of around 1.2%. Some eating disorder behaviors, such as binge eating and a dissatisfaction with eating habits, impacted almost one-third of women in their 40s. It doesn't help that their symptoms in midlife are often attributed to other causes. Diarrhea, vomiting, painful joints, and hair loss may be interpreted as part of the normal aging process, when in reality they could be side effects of an eating disorder. When the University of California conducted a 30-year study of eating disorder prevalence through life, in almost half of cases, women who had recovered from an eating disorder relapsed at 50. Perimenopausal food struggles were familiar ground for Kate Roham, 43, a personal trainer from West Sussex and a member of the Women's Health Collective expert panel. In my teens and early 20s, food was my enemy, and exercise was a punishment or way of controlling what went in. That changed when she had children, now 16, 14, and 6, in a bid to set a good example. She adopted a more self-compassionate approach, but physique changes after 40 resurfaced old habits. When I noticed my middle was getting spongier and I was struggling to maintain muscle, so many negative feelings about my body reemerged. I found myself skipping breakfast and purging calories through 90-minute daily HIIT workouts and running. The root cause of both Kate's over-exercising and Samantha's food aversion correlate with what the menopause study identified as the most common perimenopause eating disorder trigger, fear of losing control of body size. For Georgia Kohlhoff, a menopause nutritionist and counselor for specializing in body image, this desire to be a Miranda Priestley-style boss of your body shape can be traced back to the way in which society treats aging. The inbuilt belief that women have a shelf life pressurizes them to remain as youthful as possible, and often that belief shows up in how your body looks. Today, perimenopausal generation grew up seeing thinness glorified in the heroin chic era of the 90s. Now it's the glorification of resisting aging that's triggering. See headlines declaring that 50-plus celebrities look good for their age, and the Guess Who game that plays out on social media about injectable surgery or Ozempic. And as menopause awareness has morphed from compassionate campaigns into a $14 billion industry, many business and content creators, ground feeding on vulnerability, have tapped into fears with the overarching message that menopause is the root of all the problems in your body. It's thrown the brakes on your metabolism, and here's a quick fix, says Kohlhoff. Back to physiology. While women do gain an average of 1.5 5 kilograms, which equals about 3.3 pounds per year during perimenopause, according to the findings of the Healthy Women Study by Harvard University, that's not the whole story. Fat or weight gain during the menopause transition is primarily related to aging. Interestingly, men and women gain body fat at roughly a similar rate in their 40s and 50s. There's just more focus on women. It's women who are taught to control their bodies. In a further plot twist, a 2021 study of over 6,400 participants found there were hardly any changes in metabolic rate. That said, Samantha and Kate weren't imagining changes to their body. In perimenopause, the change in ratio of estrogen to testosterone causes a shift away from storing weight around the thighs and bum toward holding more body fat around the middle. This change may cause clothes to feel tighter or cling in places they didn't before, fueling an impression of weight gain. Estrogen decline also makes it harder to maintain muscle and bone density, and losing muscle can change your shape and size. Menopausal society, skeletal muscle is one of the body's greatest utilizers of blood sugar, second only to the brain, she explains. So losing muscle in this stage of life can also slow glucose metabolism, which is another reason for weight gain around the stomach. Free-falling hormones also manipulate food behaviors. First, hormones that regulate hunger and fullness are impacted by fluctuations in estrogen, meaning you're not imagining it when meals that once had you opening a trouser button now leave you eating leftovers out of the pan. Hormones can also hamper body positivity. Changes in estrogen have a huge impact on the way you think, feel, and process emotions. That might mean body gripes you could normally quash with a quick affirmation in the mirror become all-consuming, or dessert spirals into self-indulgent. Both, in turn, can influence how you eat. Changes in body shape can lead to a preoccupation with your body, a main driver in binge eating, while emotional eating is often a way to cope if you feel lonely and isolated. Before we go any further, let us say this. An eating disorder is a mental health condition and should be managed as one. If you're worried about your relationship with food, signs the NHS highlights include eating very little, exercising too much, and adopting strict habits around eating. We can talk about this later, but the experts we spoke to this about this feature were clear that evidence-based nutrition advice can play a vital role in future-proofing your relationship with food. So what's on a healthy midlife menu? Protein, and lots of it. Muscles and bones are made of protein, so to maintain strength, you need to eat enough, insists Dr. D. Giralmo, who puts the idea value at around 2 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight. That can feel hard to achieve. A 70-kilogram woman would strive for 140 grams of protein a day. As well as filling up, protein offers prolonged energy, and if you're doing your recommended 2 weight-bearing sessions a week, it will rebuild muscle mass too. Second course of advice, give yourself permission to enjoy your food. It sounds simple, but when you're fed an algorithm in which fasting and food restriction feature heavily, taking pleasure in your meals can feel groundbreaking. Cutting calories not only risks cutting protein, which weakens muscles, but it can cause low energy. That means your body hangs on to fat cells, you won't recover properly from workouts, and you're likely to get injured, all because there's not enough fuel. Ordinarily, period changes are the key warning signs of this, but with perimenopause already ticking that box, if you find yourself maintaining or gaining weight despite eating little, feeling constantly fatigued, or experiencing reoccurring injuries, apply a principle of satiation rather than deprivation to your servings. The most extreme thing you can do is go without food when your energy is already low from hormonal changes. When I see a client who's been recommended fasting by influencers, they often find themselves in a cycle of restriction and binging that they can't get out of. Of course, fasting works for some, but one study from 2022 raised concerns among researchers when it found that 8 weeks of intermittent fasting reduced levels of DHEA, a key component of estrogen, in both pre- and postmenopausal women. Beyond sensibly limiting high glycemic processed sugars such as sweets, Dr. Giralmo is critical of carbohydrate restriction. Foods such as sweet potatoes, rice, and grains are essential, especially if you're active, as well as taking a strict approach to meal tracking. Kohlhoff has two behavioral pillars to support eating well in midlife. First, replace emotional value-based language such as good, bad, healthy, or junk with objective terms such as crunchy, salt, or sweet. Then break away from conditional eating. Think like this: if I eat perfectly all week, I can have pastries at the weekend. Having unconditional permission to eat means you can make choices based on preference, hunger, and fullness versus what you should or shouldn't do. Permission is a place Samantha is working at getting to. I still feel a bit stuck, and it's having an impact on the way I feel physically and mentally, she shares. Now that my youngest has started full-time school, I can allow some extra time for planning and getting my diet right in a way that helps boost my energy. As Women's Health was going to press, she was considering psychological support with the possibility of recruiting some help from her with her nutrition. For now, I'm going to learn about my body and understand myself as best as possible. As for Kate, when she realized her approach to food was becoming disordered, she began the work of developing healthier outlets for the lack of control she felt over her body shape. She took a personal training course and became her own guinea pig, noticing how much better she felt with food in her system and adequate rest. I trained myself to eat breakfast and to not be afraid of eating more than what I would have previously thought of as enough. She noticed her muscle building and her energy coming back. And her best-selling book, Owning Your Menopause, encourages women to lift heavy and look after their bodies rather than berate them or keep them small. Perhaps the most nourishing takeaway is that mind and body disrupting fluctuations are finite. In perimenopause, estrogen production is still changing, which is what creates chaos in the body. When you hit menopause, without chaotic fluctuating hormones, your hot flashes, your mood, and your anxiety all settle. Hopefully, your relationship with food will too. And the next story is titled, How Food Can Change Your Cells. There's more to food than staving off hunger, of course, but pausing to consider that your body is built from food. What you feed it acts like a comms channel that relays vital instructions to cells, and it becomes clear how crucial nutrition is for overall health. In this extract from her best-selling book, Good Energy, Dr. Casey Means shows how a quality diet can create a quality life and help protect you from chronic disease. The path to optimal health starts with your fork. We make hundreds of daily micro decisions about food that can change our genetic and physiological fate. Like any doctor, I often ended appointments by giving patients vague dietary advice, such as eat more fruits and veggies, and then writing a prescription for medication. That's because in training, doctors are told nutrition is a soft topic that isn't evidence-based. You'll rarely find specific nutrition recommendations in the official treatment guidelines for any given condition. Interventions such as prescribing medication or performing surgery are seen as normal or even heroic, while nutritional interventions are seen as fuzzy. We ignore the fact that natural foods have over 5,000 known phytochemicals, each of which is a small molecule that has a positive effect on health. The grams of molecular information we put into our bodies affect our health daily. Every thought and feeling comes from food. Inside your mother's body, you were 3D printed from food, and every item you ingest continues to print the next iteration of yourself. Bodies, neurotransmitters, hormones, nerves, and mitochondria are all made exclusively and necessarily from what you put in your mouth. We don't arise from thin air, we arise from food. So often, doctors and patients are taught that genes are our destiny, but that's not true. Our genes don't determine most health outcomes. What we eat and how we live affect our gene expression and cellular biology, determining our outcomes. Food chemicals go into your body and act as signaling molecules. They can directly increase or decrease gene expression and activate key cell signaling pathways. What we put into our bodies is the most critical decision for our health and happiness. To learn why food is our most potent weapon against chronic disease, I had to learn the following principles for myself long after becoming a doctor. And the first one is, food determines how your cells and microbiome behave. Our bodies are built entirely of food. Eating is the process of transforming and assimilating matter from the external world into our own form. Every day, the food we eat is broken down into different types of bricks in our gut, and then those bricks are absorbed into our bloodstream to be used continually to rebuild the next version of our body. When we provide the body with the right bricks, we build the right internal structures. Also, eating matches oral input with your cells' needs. Any diet that sufficiently generates the optimal cellular function, eliminates chronic symptoms, and leads to the most favorable biomarkers is the right diet for you. Let's think about what food is from your cells' perspective. The inside of your body is warm, wet, and dark. Most of your 37 trillion cells live in darkness within you, just waiting for the signals and information about what to do and when in order to give you a good life. Cells can't hear, see, or smell. They have only receptors and channels on their membranes that allow them to receive input by waiting for nutrients to float by that they can take up and use to do their work. Food is how you communicate with your cells. Think of your consciousness and free will as being like a military general. Your cells are the troops bravely defending the integrity and safety of your life. Foods are the messages the general chooses to send that motivate the troops and tell them what to do. The general's ability to continue to lead, as well as the troop's survival, depends on the quality and clarity of the messages. In an optimal state, food sends our cells clear messages about what our body needs to do to thrive. Specific food choices and particular food behaviors can tell your body different things, such as omega-3 fatty acids in salmon, sardines, chia seeds, walnuts to immune cells. It says, lower your defenses, things are safe now. The cruciferous vegetables, such as cauliflower, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, say to DNA, it's a tough time, we must produce more defenses. Leucine, which is an essential amino acid found in beef, pork, yogurt, lentils, and almonds, says to your muscles, it's time to build. Magnesium, found in pumpkin seeds, chia seeds, beans, leafy greens, and avocados, says to neurons, relax. And fiber, to the microbiome, says, I love you, I really do. Ignore diet philosophies and focus on whole foods. Diet controversy is a charade. I personally know brilliant, hardworking, highly educated people who subscribe to polar opposite ideologies about nutrition. One group feels a low-fat, high-carb diet is the only diet that makes sense, and another feels that a high-fat, low-carb diet is the best way. Both have data that shows these diets reduce liver fat, lower weight, improve insulin sensitivity, and lower inflammation, and both are right. And in between is the famed Mediterranean diet, for which there's also masses of literature supporting a more omnivorous approach. All these diets can work towards good health because they emphasize primarily unprocessed whole foods to give the cells what they need to function and cue satiety mechanisms so we don't overeat. It's important to realize that the body is remarkably capable of getting to similar outcomes with different inputs. That is, you could be eating a sustainably sourced, unprocessed plant-based diet or animal-based diet and still get the same molecular information. Don't neglect your protein needs. As we get older and muscle mass declines, we must actively fight the process with thoughtful protein intake and regular resistance training. The recommended daily allowance for protein is 0.75 grams per kilogram of body weight, which doesn't account for activity level or dynamic metabolic needs. And the next story, how to eat unprocessed for less. The cost of living crisis is biting, particularly when it comes to filling the fridge. The latest figure saw grocery price inflation rise, with fruit and veg among the worst affected, a reality made harder by the affordability of ultra-processed food. It's a shortcoming of public policy that it's cheaper to purchase a fizzy drink than a bottle of water at many supermarkets. We must change the incentive structures of our food and health system. But until that happens, we have to do all we can to reject ultra-processed food where possible. And here's some advice for doing so while on a budget. Buy frozen organic fruit, veggies, meat, and wild-caught fish in bulk, or buy fresh and freeze. Packed frozen organic cauliflower rice costs about a lot cheaper than it and would make close to 8 meals. Cook large batches of organic beans or lentils in the slow cooker or on the stove. Buy in bulk. Purchase the cheapest organic nuts and seeds. For instance, organic flax and chia seeds are often much more affordable than organic pine nuts. Buy wild-caught canned fish, such as salmon, instead of fresh fish. And the next story is, why your freedom lies on the other side of cringe. The impulse to protect yourself from embarrassment is understandable, but as experts urge us to embrace it, its wince-phobic writer steps outside her cringe zone. It was a video of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez that caused me to consider my relationship with cringe. In the clip, which I tripped over one mundane Wednesday afternoon while scrolling X, the U.S. politician, famed for her progressive views on healthcare, prison, and climate, launches herself onto a podium at a rally with the sort of energy I'd typically associate with unadvisable levels of amphetamine use. From the speakers, rapper Cardi B's Enough crunches like a bike chain, powering you up a steep hill. AOC throws her body around with both hands in the air before standing behind the lectern to greet the ecstatic crowd and shouting into the mic. Watching it made me feel weird as nasty parts of my psyche collided with one another. It was incredible that someone could do something so heavy with potential for embarrassment with just a dab of latent bitchy schoolgirl judgment. Soon the fuzz of envy hiding beneath it came into sharper focus. Envy at AOC's self-assurance, oceans away from my own comparatively fragile confidence. Envy at the adulation, since his behavior would never fly in the UK, even if the Liberal Democrats' recent election success, in which party leader Ed Davey made cringe his campaign strategy, suggests we might be growing more amenable. Envy that she felt free to act as she pleased, knowing she'd get eviscerated in certain quarters. I scrolled past it, moved on, but a question started grinding through my mind, one that hasn't let up since. Is the fear of being cringe holding me back? You know you find something cringe because you move your body in specific and voluntary ways, not the paralysis that it rests your muscles when you mistake a fox for a predatory man in an unlit alley. Rather, it's a series of contractions, hands over eyes, knees bending in, eyes squeezing shut. To cringe is to make yourself smaller. Cringe can be used to describe feelings of intense embarrassment for oneself or others, or more intensely, shame. In the brain, it's underpinned by structures that process social and aversive experiences, which are hardwired to make you withdraw from a situation. Hardwired, it's the reason it can feel nigh on impossible to do something you see as embarrassing. You may feel paralysis because you're fighting against your brain's natural processing. The British don't have a monopoly on cringe, of course, but it feels like we experience it acutely, a deeply felt cultural terror of being perceived as conceited or gauche. Your brain learns from experiences and social norms, so this informs what's encoded as non-cringe and acceptable. From childhood, your brain is constantly trying to work out what makes you acceptable. Historically, Brits favor a stiff upper lip and value humility and politeness. So in Britain, there's a lot of information that you shouldn't be too out there. And yet there's a case for embracing cringe. Years before the internet delivered us the cringe-free cow meme, Melissa Dahl was crafting a compelling argument that personable liberation lies on the other side of cringe aversion via her book, Cringeworthy. When we chat via Zoom, she likes cringe zones to comfort zones. You have to keep in mind what you want for your life and realize that you're probably going to have to get a little uncomfortable to get it. I got laid off in January, and there's a tendency when something kind of shameful happens to hide away, but that's not a useful thing to do. I ended up sharing on LinkedIn, very honestly, what had happened and the sort of work I was looking for. The post went semi-viral, got over 100,000 views, and led to a ton of offers for work. I was sweating as I typed it out, thinking, this is so embarrassing, but I'm so glad I did it. Play it cool. The deeper I delve into the cringe hole, the more I begin to understand what your own cringe can in turn catalyze change. We often cringe at other people doing something we would be scared to do ourselves. This can be instructive. I think it relates to Carl Jung's, a Swiss psychotherapist, concept of the shadow, referring to the idea that we all have qualities that are like the underbelly of our personality. We tend to cringe at qualities or actions that others express that we're trying to disown within ourselves. But whether the part of your personality you're attempting to suppress is being demonstrative with a romantic partner or being content to sit in silence rather than feeling the need to drum up conversation, it's never fully possible, at least according to Jung's theory, which advocates integrating your shadows. Say you cringe at someone sharing their feelings on the internet. The judgment is an opportunity to look inwards and see where that's coming from, because there might be a desire there to be more open about your own feelings, that you're pretending doesn't exist. Of course, it isn't just the fear of being perceived as cringe that can cause you to overthink how much of yourself you share, but the desire to be the other C word. There's an implicit sense that a cool girl isn't easily moved, emotional, or outspoken about her feelings. For women especially, to be cool is often to be effortless, unflappable, reserved. Kate Moss's tight-lipped media policy and I've been up all night but still look hot aesthetic comes to mind. This drive is about being part of an in-group. This brings us a feeling of safety. The fear is if we aren't in that group, if we are outed as not only not cool but actually cringe, then we might be rejected. For humans, we are socially highly creatures, and that's a scary place to be. It's a sensation 32-year-old London-based Darcy Jones, who works in social media, relates to. I find being open about romantic feelings deeply cringe. I think it's partly why I spent my 20s single. I once downloaded the dating app Hinge, but deleted it after 2 weeks because I couldn't bear the idea of liking someone's profile and them knowing I might be interested. When in her 30s, she found herself in a relationship with a friend of a friend, she asked a sibling to tell her parents. I found the idea of saying, I've got a boyfriend, so cringe. The fear shows up in her social life, too. I would love nothing more than to sign up for a dance class, but the thought of going and my friends knowing gives me such cringe. I can't be arsed with people taking the piss. She chalks it up to a vicious combination of being hyper-conscious of what people think of me, but also being extremely aware of other people and their emotions. In a way, I think it's empathy gone wrong. Thing is, whether you're trying to avoid being perceived as cringe or actively trying to be perceived as cool, the net result is the same. You're putting on a performance, and doing so has consequences for your well-being. Anything that leaves you feeling that you might receive negative judgment can impact how authentically you act and how open you are about your thoughts and feelings. And when you become used to behaving in this way, be it online or with your friends, it can become a vicious cycle. The more we care about others' perceptions, the more anxious we feel about being judged negatively. Embracing edge. Not bringing yourself to climax, but showing up as yourself. Slowly, with self-compassion, bring a bit more of your authentic, cringy self into the outside world, adds Dr. Savin, with the warning that this feels hard because if you don't feel you have people around you who will support that, or worse, might tease or ostracize you, this can feel scary. So it's also worth thinking about who you can be most cringy with and spend time being your authentic self with them. Seek out cringe influencers. That politician you admire, the musician you love, those people might be cool now, but they had to transcend stuff that would make most people flinch to get to the point they're currently at, be that going to auditions or asking for things and being rejected. Seek out role models for being cringe. And that's it for tonight. So tune in next week to Women's Health. Have a great night.